and welcome to a very special edition of Mav Geeks, a military aircraft obsession, especially for International Women's Day. Now, my name's Ginny Carlin. I'm one half of the Mav Geeks team. I'm flying solo, though, on this episode, but my co-host Jamie Gordon will be so jealous when he finds out who I've been speaking to. And of course, I am going to be insufferably smug with him. Colonel Kim Casey Campbell served in the US Air Force for 24 years as a fighter pilot and senior military leader, is a keynote speaker and best-selling author, and has flown 1,800 hours in the A-10 Warthog, including more than 100 combat missions protecting troops on the ground in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Her qualifications and experience, well, there is just too much to list here, but most recently, she served as the director for the Center for Character and Leadership Development at the United States Air Force Academy. In 2003, Kim was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for heroism. She's iconic and inspirational, and she's flown a Warthog. I cannot wait for you to meet her. Colonel Kim Casey Campbell, can I just say what an absolute honour it is to speak to you today? So thank you so much for agreeing to have a little chat with me on, I keep calling it Independent Women's Day, because obviously I want to be the fourth member of Destiny's Child, on International Women's Day. Thank you so much for joining me. I've got to start by asking you, who gave you the moniker Killer Chick?
It's a great question. You know, that's been my call sign for, 20 plus years. And the way we get our call signs is after we become combat mission ready. So we've been checked out in our fighter squadron as combat mission ready. Then we go through a rite of passage, which is our naming ceremony. Generally happens on a Friday night after the week of flying. And it's a big celebration, but you're not actually in the room when they come up with names. And I remember walking back into the room and lots of cheers, and everyone said, your new call sign, your name is now Killer Chick. And I happened to be the only female fighter pilot in my squadron at the time. So it was very fitting flying the A-10. That they would come up with a call sign Killer Chick. And then once you fly in combat with it, it's really yours for life. I flew in combat very quickly after showing up to my fighter squadron, so it's been with me for a long time.
Excellent. So let's go back there. I've got so many questions to ask you. Let's go back to how you started flying. Where did the passion start?
It started when I was 10 years old, which I think even looking back now is a little crazy to me that at age 10, I decided that I had this goal, this dream. I actually wanted to be an astronaut, and that stemmed from watching the launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1986. And, you know, there was this thrill and excitement of flight and watching these astronauts, and then watching the sad, you know, the devastation really that played out in front of all of us. I think there was something at that moment. I just knew the astronauts died doing something that they believed in, something that was important, something that was more important than themselves. And I decided I was going to be an astronaut after watching that. And after talking it over with my parents, who I think were just like, thought it may be just this passing thing, that not something that I would necessarily commit to. But my dad had said, well, a lot of those astronauts are pilots, and many of those pilots went to the Air Force Academy. So I kind of just got on this track. All right, I'm going to go to the Air Force Academy. I'm going to become a fighter pilot. And then someday, ideally, go on to become an astronaut.
So how quickly did you get from going through training to get to flying the Warthog?
Well, it's quite a process. I mean, after 4 years at the academy, spent a year at pilot training, a year or another 6 months, and really our introduction to flying fundamentals of fighters, and lots of additional training, and finally got to my assignment to fly A-10s at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson, Arizona. And that was the first time of getting to fly the A-10 again. So it's a bit of a journey, but super exciting to get into that airplane for the first time and taking off for the first time, knowing that I felt like I had made it. You know, this was what I wanted to do. You know, now I'm taking off in an A-10 Warthog. It was pretty exciting.
We'll come back to the Warthog. We've got so many questions to ask you about the aircraft. But seeing as it is International Women's Day, I just wanted to bring up with you, I was reading a post that you've put on social media a few days ago where you say, I didn't want to be celebrated as a female fighter pilot because I'm a fighter pilot. But as time's gone by, has that maybe changed in the way that you're feeling about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there weren't many women when I started. And when I walked into my fighter squadron on day one, I knew I was the only female fighter pilot in the squadron. I think at the time there were roughly 35 female fighter pilots in the entire Air Force out of about 3,500. And so we definitely stood out. I mean, we stood out. And for me, that meant that I put a lot of pressure on myself because I felt like if I made a mistake or if I, you know, failed in any way that I would ruin it for all the women that followed me, which is a ton of pressure.
That's a lot of pressure.
The good side is that I also, that meant that I put in the work. I just put in a lot of effort to be good at what I did. And I felt like, you know, once I got to the point where I was combat mission ready and flown a few missions in combat, I was just a fighter pilot. That's just who I was. Mm-hmm. And so this label that we kept putting it on it as a female fighter pilot, I really didn't like it. I just was like, I'm a fighter pilot. Can I not just be accepted as that? I think what changed for me is after an experience in Iraq in 2003, and I'm sure we'll touch on that here eventually, but there were a lot of media requests. A lot of people really wanted me to talk about my experience, but it always started with this idea of me being a female fighter pilot. And I just was over it. And so I tried to turn them down. I said no multiple times. And then our public affairs officer, who I think just got fed up with me, finally said, you know, ma'am, this isn't about you. It's about sharing your story so all these young women and girls can see that they can do it too. And I was like, ooh, you were right. Like, I didn't think of it in that way. I was worried about the pressure that it would put on me. And what I realized, sharing the story meant that I was opening it up for other young women and girls and really young kids to just hear about these stories. So I think that's what changed for me really, is this idea that it is important to share the stories. Even though we've been at this for a long time, it is important for young women and girls to continue to see, you know, not just aviation, but so many different career fields out there that maybe are not traditional for women, and to let them know that if they work hard and they put in the effort, that they can do it too.
And who have been the women that have inspired you, Kim?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't have a lot of women role models growing up. Most of my role models and mentors were men throughout my career. But there were definitely some women who made an impact on my life. I will tell you, Eileen Collins was one of them. She was a shuttle commander back when I was an intern at NASA. And I got to watch her and be the shuttle commander for a mission and just watch her, you know, go on to do that, which at the time was, you know, just a new area for women. But I think also not that I had actual connection with these women, but the WASP, the women that served back in World War II, who did these amazing things and flew fighter airplanes, not in combat, but did these amazing things and that didn't get a lot of recognition for what they did, but they were out there doing it. And I think, you know, they really set an example for me. In fact, I had a picture on my wall in high school of these women, the WASPs, who walking in from a flight, and just, it was a reminder for me, like, there are women who've been there, they've done it, they've put in the work, they excelled at what they did. Mm-hmm. And it was this reminder that I could go do it too.
Fabulous. Now, let's talk about the Warthog. I've got to ask you, Kim, what is it like firing that massive cannon?
Yeah, shooting the gun on the A-10 for the first time is a full experience. I mean, I think you're not really an A-10 pilot until you actually shoot the gun. And I remember the first time going out to the range, we're all really excited. Like, this is a big day for us to go shoot the gun on the A-10. And we do a couple practice dry runs first, just making sure we get all the maneuvers and the parameters right. But when your instructor says, okay, it's time to go hot, it's like, it's this excitement that builds up. But I remember rolling in, pointing at the ground and pulling that trigger. I mean, the whole jet shakes. I mean, the gun is underneath you. So it completely rumbles underneath you. You can hear it. You can smell the gun gases. You can see the gun gases out in front of you. And then to see the bullets impact the target was pretty exciting. So yeah, a big day for all A-10 pilots is the first time you shoot the gun on that airplane.
Now, I think I'm no way even near an expert. I'm just an absolute geek when it comes to aircraft. I love aircraft and I love speaking to people that have flown them and that love them too. What was the A-10 like to fly? Because it's a beloved aircraft because it looks so funky, doesn't it? And it just looks like an absolute beast. But what was it like to fly?
So I think the thing about the A-10 is it's actually a really, I'll call it a forgiving airplane. Like it's fairly easy to fly. It is all the things that you have to do while you're flying the airplane that make it complicated, that make it complex. I mean, it's while you're flying, now you're identifying targets. You're making sure you know where the friendly location, you're coming up with the best plan of attack. You understand the threats and the risks in the area. So you're taking in all this information while also trying to set yourself up to be very precise and very accurate with your weapons. I think that's the thing that makes the A-10 more complicated and complex to fly is all the tactics, techniques, and procedures that you do while you're flying the airplane. But the airplane itself, I mean, it's a lot of fun to fly. I mean, it's very maneuverable, incredibly fun to fly low altitude at 100 feet off the ground, going through the terrain, popping up over the terrain to identify targets. I mean, it's an incredibly fun airplane to fly, but it becomes more and more complicated as you bring in lots of other factors.
I was going to say, Kim, in the 1990s, they were a regular sight over Suffolk in the UK. I used to see them and we do miss them.
I never got to fly in the UK. I went to grad school in the UK for 2 years, but I would have loved to have flown an A-10 there. Sadly, all those bases were closed when it came my turn. It's such an amazing airplane for what it does, for providing close air support for our troops on the ground, and just a really incredible airplane to fly. I love the mission. I loved flying the airplane and have to say I do miss it a bit.
I can imagine. And I mean, I was reading up on this week that the A-10, they're looking at retiring in the next few years, really. But yeah. I can't really see an aircraft that would replace it.
No, there isn't anything really in its true form that would replace the A-10. I think the important thing is that we have an airplane that is designated as the primary airplane to perform close air support, so that I think the thing that makes us really good at close air support is that we practice for it. It is our primary mission. We train for it. We understand the mindset of our ground troops. And so we need to transfer that over. If the A-10 is truly retired, which it does look like it's moving in that direction, then we need to make sure that we maintain that mindset and that performance aspect of training for it and truly understanding the mission.
Now, Kim, you touched on it earlier, your time in Iraq, that amazing story, that amazing feat. Can you take us back to 2003? What goes through you? Well, I'm not even going to speak. Can you just tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because that mission was 20 years ago. I mean, it's been almost 21 years ago now. And it really started out like every other day. I mean, it was at that time, in the war, our ground troops had reached Baghdad. And so we would just take off from Kuwait. We'd fly up to Baghdad. We'd air refuel. And then we would just wait in these stacks of airplanes, waiting to get a call from ground troops that they needed assistance. And we got the call that day. The main difference was that there were clouds over Baghdad, which is a little bit abnormal for us, but we were going to do everything that we could. We heard that troops in contact are guys on the ground taking fire needed immediate assistance. And so we were going to do everything that we could to get below the weather to make sure that we could provide them support. And I remember flying right over to the top of their location that they had given us and said, I watched my flight lead go first. And I just remember him kind of disappearing down through this hole in the clouds to get below the weather. And he said, "All right, Casey, it's your turn." And it was like, I kind of had this idea of what I would see when I popped out down below the weather, but it was, It was truly eye-opening to see this firefighting. There were bright flashes and smoke and tracers. We were lower than we normally would be, so I could see it all. And it was a very active situation. We tried to get in very quickly to use guns and rocket on the enemy location. We just did a couple passes because at one of the points, we could start seeing puffs of gray and white smoke and bright flashes in the air, now right next to us. So they're shooting at us too. So we know it's a high threat situation. So we're going to just do two passes each, climb up, get our energy back and reassess the situation. And then on my last pass, as I was pulling off target, I could just, you know, just trying to get away from the ground, away from the threat, like we always do after coming off a pass. And all of a sudden I just feel and hear a very loud explosion at the back of the airplane. And there was no doubt in my mind. I knew I was hit. The jet immediately dumped over, pointing down at Baghdad below. And my natural instinct was to just pull back on the control stick. And I did that. And absolutely nothing happened. Oh, like the jet did nothing. And I thought, this is not good. As Baghdad is now getting closer and, you know, my mind is now working, trying to work very quickly. I remember thinking that I might have to eject, and that wasn't really something that I wanted to do. So, you know, falling back on my training, trying to analyze what's going on, looking at all the lights in the cockpit. And I remember looking at my caution panel, which had multiple lights, but the ones that stood out were four at the top, telling me that my hydraulic pressure and the reservoir, everything was empty. Like I had zero hydraulics on the airplane.
Gosh.
At that point, I knew, I mean, that it was either eject or this backup emergency system better work. And thankfully, I just very quickly flipped that switch and the jet started to slowly start climbing up and away from Baghdad. That was kind of the first moment I was like, all right, I might actually survive this. Like I might actually get out of here. It was,
gosh,
yeah, everything that you talk about and never think is actually going to happen to you.
That landing was pretty special because I was reading up that you'd never even practiced that landing before because it was just too dangerous.
Right. Yeah. So the first, you know, the first moment of survival was, okay, I got out of Baghdad. So then if I still had to eject, at least my chances of survival and rescue are going to be a little bit better. But I had an hour flight home and
the whole
way back, just trying to decide, do I just get to friendly territory and eject? Or do I fly it back and attempt to land? And a lot of things going through my mind. One is that we don't train in manual reversion very frequently. We just train once during our initial training, just so we get a feel for how the airplane responds, because it's very heavy, very difficult to fly in this backup mode. And we don't train to land in it at all. It's too dangerous. At the time, we hadn't even trained in our simulators. And so that's weighing on my mind. But I also know what happened in Desert Storm. There were three pilots that attempted to land the airplane. Sadly, not all of them were successful, but there was one successful manual reversion landing where the pilot was able to get the airplane on the ground. So I knew that. I knew about their stories and I remembered those. I kind of pulled all those lessons learned, evaluated how my airplane was flying, and made a decision that I was going to try to land it, knowing that I could still eject at the last second. Just based on the design of our ejection seat. But coming into land was definitely nerve-wracking, I guess is a good word. Just not knowing what was going to happen. But we made it back into friendly territory. We did all our controllability checks. You know, we had rescue helicopters on alert. Crash recovery team is waiting for me. Not wanting to use either of those teams, but just knowing that they were there. And I remember feeling actually very confident coming into land just because I felt very good after I had flown the airplane for an hour. I felt very good with how it was flying and then just started down the final approach exactly like we always do, except for a little faster, a little steeper, just based on I was going to try to land it power on. And that feeling of hitting the ground in a fairly normal way, was such a huge relief. You know, when my first, the main gear hit and then the nose gear. And I just remember this tremendous sense of relief of like feeling like, all right, I had made it, you know, I had survived that moment. It definitely felt like it was the best landing that I had ever done. Still, to this day, by far, best landing. I don't know if it actually looked like that, but it sure felt that way.
Gosh, because the hour that you had to fly back, what goes through your head? I imagine you're trying to, like you say, get all the procedures right, but there's that human factor going through your head of what on earth is going to happen to me?
Yeah. You know, I tried to stay focused on all the procedures. I mean, there were a lot of emergency procedures, but an hour is a very long time to contemplate the fact that you may not survive. And I think, you know, I remember those little thoughts coming in and I just kept trying to push them out of my mind. You know, it's those things that creep in, like, I'm not quite ready to die, actually. You know, there's a lot of things I still want to do in my life. And you're like, nope, that's not really a great thing to think about right now. Like, shove that away, deal with that later. But really focus on the task at hand. You know, flying back, it was, you know, from a mental perspective, it was exhausting, but physically, it was exhausting as well. I mean, it was just a very heavy, heavy airplane to fly. I remember again, hearing from the pilots who had come before me, who had flown in manual reversion, and they told stories of, they would fly with both hands on the stick, you know, trade off right hand, left hand, so that when it came time to land, they could land normally with, you know, right hand on the stick, left hand on the throttle. So I remember the stories of the pilots that came before me, you know, learn the lessons from them.
And what happened to the aircraft?
Sadly, it never flew again. So they tried to fix it. They brought over a team that specializes in battle damage repair. And there were too many holes, not enough time to fix the airplane. And so they maintenance ended up taking every part they could off the airplane to use as spare parts. And then they shipped that the airframe home. And it sat in the boneyard at Davis Monthan for a bit, and then it is now on display, nicely cleaned up. There's no damage to it, but nicely cleaned up. It's on display at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in North Carolina. The damaged pieces have thankfully found homes and museums around the U.S. In fact, I just delivered a piece of the tail flash that has the tail number on it to the Smithsonian, to the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. So it will be there in a future exhibit, but just, you know, it was a little sad that it never flew again, but I was, you know, thankful that the spare parts went to other airplanes. And now there's certainly a memory of that mission and all the work that went in to make it successful. You know, the people that designed the airplane, our maintainers who put in the work to make sure it was ready to go, really a tribute to them, such an incredible airplane.
But that wasn't the end of you flying out in Iraq, was it? Am I right in thinking you were out the very next day?
I was. I ended up launching on a combat search and rescue mission the next day. So our primary mission was close air support, but we also sat alert for combat search and rescue, meaning if an aviator was shot down, that we were part of the rescue force that would go in and help pick this aviator up. And, you know, most of the time that doesn't happen. So we sit alert and we sleep, we relax, we rest, which is probably what I needed on April 8th. And then the alarm sounded and it was not a drill. An A-10 pilot had been shot down in Baghdad. And I just remember, you know, we got the call and it was just, there was no time to think. We just raced out to the jets as fast as we could. You know, we stopped, just grabbed our gear, got our gear on and made an immediate takeoff. And we made it about 30 minutes into Iraq and were told we could turn around because the pilot had by some miracle been picked up already by friendly ground troops. So he was very lucky. I think the thing for me is I knew those pilots were there for me the day before, right? I knew the rescue forces were there the day before for me. And so I was going to do the same for this pilot. You know, this is what it's all about. You know, we're not going to let each other down. And so it was, you know, for me, it was a good way to get back in the air. I don't know if that's the best way to phrase that, but it helped me like just get back in the air, get back at it, get back into the mission because there's still a war going on and we needed every pilot we could get.
And I guess all these experiences must build to where you are now. Of course, you're a best-selling author as well. All the things you've learned, you've put into that book.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that was really important to me as I was getting ready to retire was this idea of the number of people that were willing to share their stories with me, whether it was in aviation or leadership, you know, the number of people who just shared their stories and their lessons learned with me had such a pivotal impact on my life. I mean, the fact that I'm flying home from Baghdad and I remember stories that were shared with me. I remember stories from a book that was written about pilots in Desert Storm called Warthog. I mean, I remembered those things. And so it was all about this idea that when we share our stories and we share those experiences, even if they sometimes expose those mistakes or weaknesses, you know, our failures in life, those stories and the lessons that go with them can help other people on their journey. And that's really what it came down to for me, was this idea of, it's not about me, right? It's about helping this next generation of aviators and leaders. And that's really what I've dedicated to my life to post-retirement from the Air Force.
Kim, it's International Women's Day. What is your wish for young and older girls and women who are wanting to further their career into a STEM career, into aviation? What is your wish today for them?
I think the important thing is, like, don't hold yourself back. Like, if there's something that you want to do, no matter what it is, don't prejudge yourself. Don't be so hard on yourself. Like, just go for it. And it's more of just saying, I have a goal, or I have a dream, or I've set this objective for myself. You have to put in the work. I mean, none of this is easy. And so you have to put in the work. That's the most important thing. But sometimes, me included, I look back on my early life and I prejudged myself. I was very hard on myself and put a lot of pressure on myself. And I realized that we probably need to give ourselves a little bit of grace. Like, things aren't always going to go as planned. You are going to make mistakes. You are going to fail along the way. It is all about what you do in those moments. Can you get back up again? I mean, these goals, these dreams, they're not easy, but set them and then work hard and know that there's going to be ups and downs on your journey, and keep after it. If it's what you want, then keep after it.
Kim, one last question, and it has to be about the Warthog. I imagine that you've probably been and sat in the Warthog since. When you've had that time away from the aircraft, when you get in, does it just smell the same?
You know, I actually just recently was at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force and in Dayton, Ohio. And I was there to deliver a few of my a piece of my airplane and some flight equipment to them for a display. And as part of it, we did an interview, and they said, what do you think about doing part of the interview from the cockpit of an A-10? And I was like, oh, yes, I will happily do that. I will tell you, when I stepped in that seat again and sat down, it was like almost this overwhelming emotion that came through. Like, it felt like home. It felt like comfort in many ways, but it was like this, I don't know, it was just this feeling of all those things that I had done throughout my career and how important that airplane was to me, and just the things that we were able to do and the people that we were able to help. I don't know, it just brought back so many memories, so much emotion. And it smelled exactly like I remembered it. You know, it's just, there's something about getting in that old cockpit again. And this was a pretty old airplane that they had in the museum there, but it was, it just brings back so many good memories. I mean, I love that airplane. I love that it saved my life. And so it's definitely has a special place in my heart.
Colonel Kim Casey Campbell, it's been an absolute honor to speak to you today. Thank you so much for joining us. And
absolutely.
And happy International Women's Day.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm not going to lie, the fangirlometer was off dying the scale. What a privilege to hear from Colonel Kim Casey Campbell. And of course, the A-10 Warthog is every Mav Geek's dream. To find out more of Kim's story and details on the book, go to kim-casey-campbell.com. So that's just about it from me on this very special International Women's Day episode of Mav Geeks, a military aircraft obsession, and one that I will not forget in a hurry. Jamie and I will be back before you know it with Series 5. If you need your Mav Geeks fix, then you can always listen back through the past few series at bfbs.com/podcasts or wherever you normally listen to your pods. And I almost forgot, we'd be really grateful if you could drop us a nice review. And if you think there's something we should be covering, drop us a line at mavgeeks@bfbs.com. It's cup of tea time for me. It's got to be. We'll catch you soon. Ta-ra.